I'm going to talk about the French Revolution. It's hard to do, and I'll leave myself about 45 minutes after I screw on at the beginning. I want to do two things. I want to see the revolution through the eyes of Maximilien Robespierre, member of the Committee of Public Safety, arguably with Saint-Just, its most important member. Jacobin, in a way, he incarnated Jacobin. He incarnated the French Revolution, and in doing so, I want to talk about the terror, and above all, why it was that people supported or opposed the revolution, and it comes down a great deal to religion, as we'll see. But first, because I promised that we had the only live bootleg, album of the trial of the king. And of his execution, I thought I'd play those, and also the death of Citizen Marat in his bathtub. And to do that, I decided to bring a prop, because this is, we're going to talk about, and I don't mean, I'm not making light of instant death. I just finished a book about a guy who ends up with putting his head in the little window. You knew people were smaller back in those days, but you really didn't imagine that they were this small. Do you know what this is, what this comes from, this guillotine? Aya, massa. Do you know what this is for? This is a real, that hurt actually when I did that. Don't write your parents, especially your freshmen, and say, God, he was running around waving a guillotine, running around the place. There he goes again. No, this is for cigars. This is for cigars.
Yeah. My
idea. Was that your idea?
You did.
Don't smoke. Anyway, can you put on the first one? This is the trial of the king. Simon?
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. The CD. This is the king. I'll just translate part of it. I'm not going to translate the whole thing. It doesn't matter if you don't know French. This is just for ambiance. This is ambiance. Yeah. They're putting him on trial. Oh. He did bad things. I'll translate part in a minute. This takes probably too much time, but it's cool. This is from a rock opera. La Révolution Française. Keith Richards live here. Keith Richards. Yeah. This is too long to get to it. Apologize. But Louis XVI, this was his finest moment. This is not Louis XVI. Shit. They're going to ask him to respond to the charges, and the old boy will. Answer the act of accusation, the indictment. What you've done against the nation. But it's nice. Listen. Yeah. I should have started with the next one, actually. No. This is it. Among you, I'm looking for judges, and all I see is accusers. I won't do the whole thing. I never did this horrible thing, ignominious thing. I never betrayed my country, which is patently false. Oh, life has given me some misfortunes, and death doesn't frighten me at all. Maybe you can do France better than me. They're saying. Take care of France better than I could. Keep it from its own excesses. Take care of my family. They didn't come out very well either. Take care of my children. It's only favors. That I really, you know, ask you to carry out. Je n'ai plus rien à vous dire. I have nothing more to say to you. And they're going to vote now. Got live. Got dead. La mort. Death. Saint-Just. La mort. Marat. He'll get his in a few minutes. He would get his too. Okay, now they execute the old guy. Next, please. This is the death of Citizen Marat. He meets Charlotte Corday, who is from Normandy and a royalist. He's in his bathtub. I won't translate everything. Oh. Citizen, you're coming without knocking? Yeah, you're seeing Citizen Marat all nude in his bath. What's your name? Charlotte. Ah, would you have very nice eyes? Come here, a little closer. What can I do for you? I won't translate that. Do you like them, citizen? Ah. Why are you looking so mean all of a sudden? To make you afraid, you bastard. What's the knife for? You heard it live, that's it. Okay. Can we get the lights, please, Simon? Leave me a little. Whoop. Maximilien Robespierre was born on May 6, 1758 in Arras, a beautiful town destroyed in World War I in the north of France. His father was a lawyer, who was a son and grandson of lawyers. His father married the daughter of a well-do brewer, and they were married a few months before the birth of Maximilien. Two daughters, one who died, this was fairly normal, and Augustin, his brother, followed. His mother died giving birth to a fifth child who barely survived her. The father was unstable, always leaving home at the time of the birth of all of his children. He finally died in Germany. So Robespierre never had a family. Psychohistorians have done a lot with this. The family of four was left to care in the care of a maternal grandmother and by aunts. So essentially he was an orphan at the age of eight. He felt his father's guilt about causing the death of his wife. After his sister remembered, after his father left, disappeared, a total change came about in him. Formerly like all other children of his age, he was thoughtless and turbulent and flighty. But since he became the family head, so to speak, by virtue of being the eldest, he's become settled. and responsible and laborious. He spoke to us with the kind of gravity which impressed us. If it was to take part in our games, it was in order to direct them. He loved us tenderly, and there were no attentions and caresses that he did not lavish upon us. Henceforth, if you buy the psychohistorian's interpretation, he could only be a man of order. He desperately tried to assimilate himself to the social order. He both loved and hated his father as he adored his dead mother. His whole life was marked by a feeling of his father's guilt, which also represented the death in a real way of his own childhood. And in his last hours, his death wish, his inability to act when he might have saved himself, can be seen, if you will, in that context. He was forced into a seriousness and responsibility. He always had a passion for solitude, isolation. He knew what it was to be poor. He was an example sort of downward mobility, if you will. He went to school, and he was really smart, supported by charitable foundations, first in Arras and then in Paris, at age 11 to the Collège or Middle School of Louis le Grand, where he became a star classic scholar. He was selected among all the other pupils to read a poem that he had composed to none less than the king and the queen as they passed by Reims, also in the north of France, in Champagne country. But as it was raining, the king and the queen ordered the driver to go on, not stopping to listen to Robespierre's little speech, little poem, and indeed splashing his only good suit of clothes with mud as they drove off. He became a lawyer, getting his degree in 1780 in Paris, a lawyer at the Parlement of Paris. His scholarship passed, as things did in the old regime, to his younger brother. He entered prizes for literary contests that were run by the Académie. At once it said that he even caught sight of the great Rousseau, but that seems a little unlikely. But in Metz, where the Academy awarded him £400, which was a lot of money, and he was elected to the Academy of Arras. In law cases, he championed the poor, the humble. He took the side of a man in an abbey who had been accused by the monks of a theft, when in fact one of the monks had done the ripping off. He once said, when somebody was condemned to death, "I know very well that he is guilty, but I can't imagine to send someone to his own death." At the beginning, but only in the beginning, he did not believe in capital punishment, although arguably those who agree with him would say that he saved the revolution by meting out capital punishment. Because of his reputation, I mean, this was sort of a classic case of a young, you know, lawyer on the make. He's elected to the Estates General from Artois. He's unknown when he goes to Paris. He's called in the minutes sometimes Robes-Pierre, sometimes Robespierre, sometimes Robert, like the name Roberts, Pièce, or sometimes simply Robert, if that was his first name, and Pierre, his second name. But he began to make a mark, speaking always very softly. 68 times he spoke in 1789, and he gradually gets his reputation there. He opposes all restrictions on the freedom of the press, and of course that would change later as well. He invokes Rousseau's concept of the general will to support the view that the king should have no right to oppose or delay legislative measures proposed by the assembly. You know this from your reading. He sided on the left of the assembly with those who went to Varennes to bring back Louis XVI when he and Marie Antoinette tried to hightail it to the southern Netherlands, or that is, to Belgium. That was the king, by the way. He should have been there first. Attends, what am I doing here? Okay, that's the king. There's Marat, fully clothed. And there is Maximilian Robespierre. Although he spoke often, he lacked presence and color, and this would be the case until the very end. The English writer Carlyle saw him as anxious, slight, an ineffectual-looking man in spectacles, his eyes troubled, careful, with an upturned face, dimly trying to understand the uncertain future times. But he spoke with an intense passion and conviction, a belief in all that he said. Mirabeau, who died of syphilis, one of the king's main advisors, said of him, that man will go far because he believes every single thing that he says. He seemed rigid in his principles, plain, unaffected in his manners. Nothing said an Englishman of the volatility of a Frenchman in his character. He supported the idea that all citizens, all male citizens, should have the right to vote, and thus he opposed the idea of having active citizens who paid taxes and passive citizens who did not have enough money to pay taxes and thus could not vote. He calls for, the, among others, with the deposition of the kings being deposed, both in the legal sense and being deposed from the monarchy. He was already known as the incorruptible, and he received letters of admiration. Once leaving the assembly, a crowd put oak leaves around him and carried him around the city in triumph. He always wore impeccably white clothes, and he wore a powdered wig, which is very much of an old regime thing and not a revolutionary thing. He was not somebody who was going to go out and tutoie easily, and the revolutionaries tutoied as a form of that is in the familiar form, like du in German, as opposed to sie, that familiar form. All were equal, therefore you didn't say vous to people who were above you in the social ladder. He didn't like people touching him, and indeed, probably, he was chaste. He had only a few flimsy and only by mail flirtations with women. And when they picked him up, you have to imagine a sort of a crassly American analogy, but a football coach who sort of swept off his feet after a big upset or something. And he doesn't like people touching him. He doesn't like being carried away by them. One of the letters, and he was ascetic, always preferred being alone. Ate very modestly. One letter to him said, incorruptible as you are courageous, and he was that, you have always openly displayed your feelings. It has never been self-interest that has made you act or speak, only the general interest. He identified with ordinary people, and he ends up living in Western Paris, a more prosperous part of Paris, but in the home of a carpenter on a street called the Faubourg Saint-Honoré. And those were really his happiest moments because it provided him with a family that had young children in it that he really hadn't had a very normal circumstance. And people who came to see him saw him sort of stretched out on the couch with his family trying to guess from the way he looked what he might want. Would he want more grapes? Would he want more milk? Et cetera, et cetera. He read a lot. He wrote his speeches, which were written out by hand, always well combed and powdered, in the cleanest of dressing gowns, et cetera, et cetera. Now, he began to be a frequenter of the Jacobin Club. Now, these clubs, like the Feuillants and the Cordelier and the Jacobins, were called that not because they had anything to do with the religious orders, like the Jacobins were a religious order, because the biggest places you could meet were churches and abbeys. Those were always the biggest buildings. And so the Jacobins, who were on the left of these clubs, this began meeting right even before the Bastille falls on the 14th of July, 1789, he begins to go to the Jacobin Club, and the Jacobins become the great left-wing centralizers of the revolution. They trumpet the authority of the Parisian sans-culottes. That's a term, another French term so important, it worked its way into the English encyclopedia or dictionaries. The sans-culottes were those who supported the revolution. Technically, if you said a sans-culotte was somebody who's not wearing pants, but that's not what it meant. What it meant was not wearing fancy kind of aristocratic breeches, and it became identified with a form of political behavior. You could be an aristocrat, and there were liberal aristocrats in a meeting in a club called the Club of the 30, who helped push the revolution really toward constitutional monarchy, at least in the beginning. If you were against the revolution, you're an aristo, you're an aristocrat. If you were for the revolution, you were part of le peuple, the people. and you chose the color red because red becomes the color of the left-wing interpretation of the revolution. And you gave people kisses on both sides of the cheeks, or three times, depending on where you are, were in France, as recognizing the solidarity you had as being a citoyen, that is a male citizen, or a citoyenne, a female citizen as well. The whole idea of kissing, by the way, is terribly important in France, but that's mostly a late 19th and really 20th century thing, because people really kept their distance. Whereas now, you know, if you live in Paris, you kiss twice, or in the 16th arrondissement, not at all, you merely shake hands. If you live in the Parisian suburbs, often you kiss four times. If you live in the south of France, you kiss three times. In the department of the Hérault, which is Bas-Languedoc, if you live in Béziers, you kiss three times. If you live in Montpellier, which is a more aristocratic city, traditionally a more formal city, though it's a big university town, it really rocks, you kiss only twice. But this idea of kissing people on the cheeks was a sign of revolutionary solidarity, and symbols were very, very important. If you carried pikes around, pikes at the Battle of Valmy, which you can read about, it's the pikes of the sans-culottes that stopped the highly professional armies of the enemies of the revolution. So he believes in the necessity of a single will. Again, this comes out of Rousseau's idea of the general will to save the revolution against its enemies. And he is one of the people that helped push the French Revolution to the left. Now, and his principles were totally unshakable. He doesn't budge on them at all. And of course, you know, it's just insane to look back and see in Robespierre, you know, the origins of totalitarianism, despite the Committee of Public Safety. Robespierre also, you know, was a man of his times. He was not against all property. He was against les gros, people having too much unearned property. He thought everybody should have enough to get along, but that even people who didn't have any property and couldn't and thus didn't pay any taxes, as I said before, ought to have the right to vote. He also, like the Jacobins, believed that they ought to have enough to eat. And one of the tensions that one found in French revolutionary political clubs and political societies and in the sections, neighborhood sections, that began planning how you would defend your neighborhood against foreign invaders or insurgents from within, the price of bread, of course, counted enormously. And in a couple of weeks, I'm going to talk about what difference bread made in terms of popular protest. Because people who believed in the kind of free trade that Turgot had in the 1870s believed that the market ought to determine the price of bread. But there was always a tradition that the price of bread ought to be kept at a reasonable amount, so everybody ought to have enough to eat. And so the Jacobins, most of them, believed in the maximum, which was a maximum on the price of bread. Now, their enemies on the revolutionary left, or sort of left central, were called the Girondins, whom I wrote on the board and a name I sent around on the class server. The Girondins, a G-I-R-O-N-D-I-N-S, which is also the name of the Bordeaux soccer team, were from Bordeaux and the department of the Gironde, many of them were. They are merchants, they are free trade people, and they also were extremely interested in launching foreign wars carry liberty, fraternity, and equality abroad. Now, scrambling for this great quote, the Girondins were in love with war, and there was this great kind of rhetoric about conquest and carrying freedom in quotes to other countries. Though one had to be, and many people were cynical about this, when the French troops poured into the Rhineland, the prostitutes of the Rhineland cities dressed up in red, white, and blue flags to welcome their new clients. Robespierre made a series of speeches against this Brissot, who was the former Grub Street writer that I mentioned before, arguing that France should not go to war. He said that, and more about this in a minute, that the danger to the revolution did not come from a handful of émigrés in Germany, but from within France, from the counter-revolution. And that's important, and that's worth underlining. And secondly, he argued that launching wars all over the place will merely play into the hands of the king, who at this point was still the king, and the counter-revolutionaries, perhaps paving the way for some sort of military dictatorship. How forward-looking was that? Because that's exactly what they ended up with, of course, with Napoleon. Moreover, he argued that war would separate soldiers from the rest of the people. And indeed, although the levée en masse, my guillotine almost fell down, would sort of compromise that because all citizens become soldiers, et cetera, et cetera. But he said something, this is an amazing little speech that he gave, and I'm going to read just a few lines of it, because if you think about current politics in this country in the last, say, 5 years, it may also ring true. He said, this is Robespierre, the most extravagant idea that can arise in a politician's head is to believe that it is enough for a people to invade a foreign country to make it adopt their laws and their constitution. No one loves armed missionaries. The Declaration of the Rights of Man is not a beam of sunlight that shines on all men, and it is not a lightning bolt which strikes every throne at the same time. I am far from claiming that our revolution will not eventually influence the fate of the world, but I say that it will not be today. Amazing. He lost this debate in 1792, and in fact, his denunciation of plots against the revolution may have contributed to revolutionary paranoia, which would be acting out in the Terror. But on the 20th of April, 1792, the Girondins and the king got their wish, and war was declared on Austria, and French troops crossed into Belgium, that is the Austrian Netherlands, and the wars went on and on. Now, I want to make a couple points that are pretty important. I'm not going to use these papers to do this. That the threat to the revolution did not come just from Austria, from Great Britain, from Prussia, from Russia, from the big allies. And Robespierre got this right. There are two, and the timing of this you can read about it in the chapter, and please do. There were two main counter-revolutionary threats to the revolution. The first, which was not the most important, but still is worth mentioning, was what has been called the Federalist Revolt. The Federalist Revolt. And this was based in cities in which merchants, free traders, played a big role in that. Here is a map of La Belle France. Now, Bordeaux, we've already talked about. You've got all these wine merchants and all this fancy land and who merchant other things as well. You've got Marseille. Big Toulon is not yet a huge port to become in the 19th century. You've got Marseille. You've got Lyon, then France's second city, first in gastronomy, one could still argue, today. Varennes was merely where the king is caught. That's up there. By the way, in 1790, they, in order to undercut local elites, that is clergy and nobles, and also to impart a more rational organization of the country, comes right out of the Enlightenment, out of the philosophe, they create departments. They name most of them after rivers, though some are named after mountains, and they create a capital in each of them. For example, none of this matters, but it's just to tell you what's going on. That's the Haute-Vienne, the capital of Limoges, that's the Corrèze, capital is Toul, up there is the Creuse, capital is Guéret, this is the Landes, Mont-de-Marsan, this is the Pyrenees, the Atlantic Pyrenees, the capital is Pau, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the Federalist Revolt, also in Caen, that's where the aforementioned Charlotte Corday came from that part of, that's the department of the Calvados, which is also the name of a wonderful apple brandy. So the Federalist Revolt comes in cities like it comes in, above all, in Lyon, Caen, Marseille, Toulon, and Lyon. And of course, the revolutionary armies, the armies of ordinary citizens in the Republic, what had become the Republic, crush them. They crush them like grapes. In Lyon, one of the members of the Committee of Public Safety, who was confined to a wheelchair, a man named Couton, that you can read about, C-O-U-T-H-O-N, says he's going to plow Lyon under like Carthage, and they do execute people on the Place Bellecour. And so this Federalist revolt is against the Jacobins. It's against the sort of Parisian-centered, far-left interpretation of the French Revolution. By the way, there are groups on even further to the left, and the Jacobins really weren't that far to the left, but there are groups like the Enraged, Les Enragés. There's even a guy called Gracchus Babeuf, who believed that property should be abolished, but these are just very small groups. Babeuf is guillotined in Vendôme, which is south of Paris, near the Loire, and his trial is a wonderful source, actually, the trial of Gracchus Babeuf, an original source. So anyway, that's the Federalist revolt. But the most important threat to the revolution comes from peasants. It comes from peasants in the west of France, also down where we live, in this part of France too. That comes later. But basically, what I'm going to talk about for a few minutes is the revolt in the west. Now, it was often said that peasants would never march more than a day away from their fields. But certainly, you know, as Mao and lots of other people have shown, or Ho Chi Minh, that's not the case at all. The war was fought with a savagery, with a brutality that was simply, you know, staggering. There were massacres on both sides. The Vendée, which is in dark there, became a department, number 80, good old number 85. But it became such a major bloodbath that the entire counter-revolution in the West is often simply called the Vendée. I am in history literally because I read a long time ago a book written by my late and much missed friend Charles Tilly called The Vendée, which sought to explain and did explain and really hasn't been nuanced very much over the decades why some people opposed the revolution taking big time chances and other people who didn't live that far away supported the revolution. And so what he found, he studied an area that it doesn't matter where, but sort of the north of that dark area, actually in the Maine-et-Loire, a different department. Here's another French word that's also English, called in the Bocage country, B-O-C-A-G-E. It's the hedgerow country. And he found that the people who rose up against the revolution and took big time chances, I mean, the Republicans didn't screw around, and there was a lot of just horrible brutality. They drowned thousands of clergy in the swirling waters of the Loire River, which is a really dangerous river, by putting them out into the river with holes drilled in the bottom of the boat, which didn't give them a big hope. They killed lots of people on the Ile de Ré, which is up here off La Rochelle. And of course, the forces representing the monarchy, representing the nobles, were, if anything, even more brutal. They crucified people, literally. They made them, kiss the cross before they beat them to death. It was really, a nasty time. But looking at it, people who rebelled and ones who didn't, the areas, one of the things we can say, at least by that particular area, but it really rings true, is that areas in which that traditional elite, noble and priest, had not been broken down by the economic and social changes of the 18th century. They were physically isolated. These hedges, you see them up in the upper part of Normandy too, lower Normandy, but high up there on the near Cherbourg in the Manche. These are huge hedgerows that you literally, can't fight your way through. And can't really climb over. And people tended to marry within their village or within a nearby village. They still, the priest still walked tall. The noble was somebody who they still respected, even though the nobles had left, many of them are left. And even though many of them, they still had to pay dues to the nobles. And their only contact with this kind of bourgeois world of economic change was with people who were farming taxes, for example, whom they hated. people that were putting out work into the countryside who cheated them and said, well, I told you I'd give you 5 sous last time, but there are a lot of women doing that same work. I'm going to give you 3, and if you don't like that, too bad. I'll walk away and I won't take the cloth work that you've done for me. Too bad for you. Or people that collected the taxes for the nobles. And so if you look up further along the Loire River, where you had this sort of economic change in the 18th century, people accepted this new lead, and they were willing to ditch the idea of the monarch. It wasn't to say that they all went read Rousseau instead of the Bible before they went to bed, but these were big time changes that reflected the way things had evolved. Now let me give you some more examples. Now, one of the most important moments of the French Revolution, and this is also worth remembering, and you can read about it, the civil constitution of the French clergy. Because the revolutionaries get the very good idea that you're broke, we already know that, the monarchy's just flat broke, so where are you going to get the money? Who has money? Well, nobles who leave France have money because they have a lot of property, particularly in areas like Brittany and in Burgundy, and in the Île-de-France, that is the island of France around Paris. But the church has enormous amounts of money, enormous amounts of land. So what they do is they essentially nationalize the church, the details you can get, and they force people to take an oath to the French Revolution, to the nation. Now, in certain parts of France, particularly those that rose up against the revolution, the priests don't take the oath. They refuse to. And they are called non-juring, that is, non-swearing priests, J-U-R-I-N-G. In other parts of France, the priests were more willing to take the oath, and they were called juring clergy. So this is important. If you just look at this map, you see this is by a canton, cantons, within departments. But you see all that white up in Brittany in those revolutionary areas. It corresponds exactly to the area of people who fought against the French Revolution, because the clergy still has enormous influence, and sort of the nobles, even if they're living in England at the moment, or living in Britain, or living in the Austrian Netherlands, or in the Rhineland, or somewhere else in Germany. This isn't enough. I mean, that's not enough, because we have to see really what, here we go, this is by district, this is an even better map of it. And you see that in the central part of France here, that priests refused to swear allegiance, as in our village, to the French Revolution. But in Brittany and in Normandy, they did massively. And in Alsace and Lorraine, they did massively. And in the north of France, they did massively. So, okay, but I mean, that's fine, that's interesting. But so what's going on here? What's going on? Why does it go like that? It's not just that people also get together and say, let's not swear to the revolution, let's go have a drink of Calvados instead. More important changes are going on. Now, the word de-Christianization, which I also sent around, has two meanings. One is the campaign against the church by the revolutionaries. To melt down church bells, et cetera, et cetera. De-Christianization, to change the calendar so that it's no longer January, February, March, but it's Germinal, Thermidor, Ventos, names that have to do with winds and plants and the agricultural calendar. That's part of de-Christianization. But that's not the big issue. The issue is that in these areas in which the revolution was accepted, that old-time religion was on the rope. A friend of mine who was a great historian called Michel Vauvel, long time ago, did a book on de-Christianization. He looked at part of Provence, and he looked at how people, what they did with their money in wills. They looked at the number of people who became priests or nuns. He looked at all sorts of things. How many people baptized their children within the 3 days you were supposed to in the Catholic Church. And what he found is that the church, it wasn't the revolution that destroyed the role of the church, or that reduced the role in ordinary people's lives, that had already happened. And it began after the Counter-Reformation, that is the Catholic Reformation. It was already well underway by the 1730s and the 1740s. So you can see political behavior here reflecting these big-time important trends. You know, it's another way, you could look at bishops' sermons. You look at how people name their children. You know, in the 19th century, when they stop naming their children after saints, local saints, for example, that's another good indication. Or, you know, you don't have many people named Marie Magdalene anymore in France, or that kind of thing. Or in the Limousin, named Martial or Léonard, these names of local saints. So these, and here again, the areas that were counter-revolutionary, particularly up in Brittany and you know, Poitou and those regions there, the big story was these major kinds of change. Ultimately, what I'm saying then is religion was very likely to be arguably the most important cause for people supporting or opposing the revolution, particularly the radical revolution, as the Committee of Public Safety sat around this big table and made big decisions. Now, what about the terror itself? The interpretations of the terror basically have gone like this. One, it was sort of a bloodletting by the very poor of their social betters. Well, that's pretty much nonsense. Secondly, that it's a reflex action to save the Republic. Well, that makes more sense. Basically, and somebody in the 1930s, before there was really quantitative history, went to look. A guy called Donald Greer said, let's look at the victims of the terror. And what he finds fits into where we started, which is Maximilien Robespierre and his attempt to save the revolution. That the most people in the terror, there was a higher percentage of clergy and nobles executed because there are small percentages of clergy and particularly nobles in the French population. But the vast majority of people that either were given prison sentences or had put their heads through the little window or were shot down, executed, like executed as in Lyon, were peasants and were artisans. Why? I mean, because there were more peasants than artisans, above all peasants, in France than any other social group. Now, that's good. I mean, that's good to know that. But even more important, that the incidence of the terror in the French Revolution come in areas that are battle zones, that they reflect, the war, the professional soldiers of monarchies fighting in the north of France or fighting in the east of France, and they reflect the Civil War, is that a lot of people were put to death or were executed because they were fighting or participating in supplying troops in battle zones. It's possible, as my friend David Bell has argued, to say that parts of this represent the first total war. I'll talk more about that when we get to Napoleon, because it's an interesting subject. But anyway, the terror was no sort of bloodletting, organized bloodletting, or spontaneous. It was that too, despite the horrible incidents, despite Nantes and despite the massacres and the prisons in September massacres in Paris. There was a logic to this, and it had to do with trying to save the revolution. Now, back to Maximilien Robespierre. Fumbling through his papers here to get to the appropriate point. They tried to kill Robespierre, of course, as the terror gets more organized, and he had a tendency, as is Saint-Just and the other ones, to say, if we just have one more terror, one more round of terror, we'll finally save the revolution and all will be well. But lots of people in the assembly looked around reasonably enough and said, we might be the next victims. He became increasingly tired, fatigued. He was never, a dramatic speaker, but it was as if he no longer wanted to be heard. Two attempts on his life, it finally got him to come to the Jacobin Club and to go the convention. It's possible to argue that death and revolutionary immortality was something that he chose because of his own childhood guilt, a primal guilt. About his own father and the death of his mother. For someone who was ascetic and withdrawn and preferred to be alone, he became increasingly that way, unable to act. In 1794, in Thermidor, the month of Thermidor, he became increasingly obsessed with his own end, his own demise. He says, if Providence had seen fit to snatch me from the hands of the assassins, it was to ensure that I would profitably employ the moments that still remain to me. Yet he could only, as people howled at him from every conceivable angle in the convention, almost inarticulately. When he mounts the rostrum on the 8th of Thermidor, he gives an incredibly clumsy speech for Robespierre. I need to unburden my heart. Everyone is in a league against me and against those who hold the same principles that I hold. What friend of the nation would wish to serve the nation when he no longer is allowed to serve it? Why remain in an order of things in which intrigue eternally triumphs over truth? How may one bear the torture of seeing this horrible succession of traitors? Perhaps he thought that his own death would rouse the patriots, that is, the sans-culottes in the sections, in the neighborhoods of particularly central in eastern Paris. 11 times he is shouted down, and people shouting, "Down with the tyrant," and he says only, "I ask for death." He leaves with his brother and with Couthon, and they go to the town hall. The same building is not there, but it's in the same plot, the same spot. And they wait upstairs. And occasionally somebody would say to him, "Well, why don't we go out and rouse up the sections? Why don't we, you know, we are at great risk here." And they just sit there. They sit in this room. They sit there all night, and finally, inevitably, the troops of the conspiracy run up the stairs. Couthon tries to escape in his wheelchair, and the wheelchair bounces along with him down the stairs. Robespierre either takes a pistol and shoots himself in the jaw, or is shot in the jaw. And he spends time trying to rub the blood because of he had this thing about clean white clothes. Until they know what to do with him, at one point he's lying on a table, and he points with Saint-Just. They point to the Declaration of the man, of the rights of man and of citizen, and they said, "We did that," and indeed they did. And they find themselves taken to the Conciergerie, that is the prison of the Conciergerie, which is still there. It's no longer a prison. It's one of the great Gothic halls, one of the three great Gothic halls in France, along with Avignon and Mont-Saint-Michel. And of course, the trial is as he would have had it, and had it for the enemies of the revolution, is quick, with no defense really permitted. The next morning, they clip his hair back, as one did, so that the long hair would not in any way slow the blade of the guillotine. And they take him, put him in a wagon, and it takes, because there wasn't very good way, there were not major thoroughfares through Paris, they take him to the Place de la Révolution, which is now called the Place de la Concorde, and they pass him by his house, the house of the carpenters which he stayed, where he had had his happiest moments. And as he gets closer to the Place de la Révolution, where he's going to meet Sanson, the executioners are all, it's a blood trade after all. And rather like butchers, they all intermarried, and they lived outside the walls of cities. He's going to meet Sanson. And as he gets there, he surely noticed that the women were more and more well-dressed, and so were the men. And as he gets there, they're shrieking at him, of obscene term to go with, "Down with the maximum on the price of bread." It's a different crowd. It's a very different crowd. Thousands of people came to hear, lean forward to catch the last words, to see the head held above, as they did with Louis XVI and with Marie Antoinette. "Hold my head up, it's a good one," said Danton, or something like that, when they'd executed him on Saint-Just and Robespierre's orders before. And he meets Sanson with his, with blood pouring out of the bandage holding his jaw on, having come loose. And even at the end, even if they shove his head into the little window, blood is pouring from him. And one doesn't know. We can't imagine, as he looked up, as his head is down, as he looks up, he sees the throngs who have paid a fine price to sit on the roofs. It's like being across from Wrigley Field or something like that, to see the death of the tyrant. Tyrant? Or the person who saved the revolution, or one of them. It's very hard to say. It depends on your view. But certainly, one can imagine that Robespierre breathed a breath of of relaxation, of leaving an existence that had tortured him, and of gaining for the revolution he hoped revolutionary immortality, but also perhaps, one can argue, paying a debt to his family that stemmed from the death of his own mother long before in Arras. See you on Wednesday.